Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. Okay, Peter Parker was the drummer of Dirty Looks. 2 weeks ago, I was playing one of their songs on the radio, as I do periodically, and I thought, let's see if I can find somebody who was in this band. One guy died of a heroin overdose. The lead singer seems to have mainly dropped out of Earth, and there's one song of his I found out after this interview, really during it, that's on Bandcamp. One song with no information, and it does list his hometown in Vermont. And other than that, there's no sign of that guy. So I was able to find the drummer quite easily on Facebook. He's a loquacious, interesting guy, still drumming, and was able to recount vividly the story of this band. So I'll leave it at that. Here it is, my interview with Peter Parker from the band Dirty Looks. Okay, there is Dirty Looks with Accept Me featuring Peter Parker on the lead vocals there. He was the drummer of this Staten Island band. We've been listening to them all morning. We've been talking about them for a few weeks now, and I'm just pleased Peter could join us this morning and sort of give us the lowdown on the band Dirty Looks. Peter, good morning and welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Good morning. I am doing absolutely fabulous and here in ice cold Wisconsin.
Yeah, you moved from Staten Island to Wisconsin, but I'll tell you one thing I'm extremely pleased that I can tell already is that you have not lost your Staten Island accent.
No, definitely not. And it's kind of weird because when I first talk to people here in Wisconsin, they kind of walk back, you know, they kind of like take a few steps back, and it's like, wow, you're not from here, are you? It's like, nope, sorry, wasn't born here in Wisconsin, and they pick it up right away. Actually, they think I'm from Boston at first, and it's like, yeah, no, not really. The Boston accent and New York accent is very different, but a lot of people here in Wisconsin think the Boston accent and New York accent is basically the same, which you know it's not.
Yeah. So you were born in Staten Island, is that right?
Born and raised in Staten Island in Zungen Hills, yes.
And is this before the bridge was built?
Oh, way before the bridge was built. Oh, yeah. The bridge didn't finally open up until 1965. That's when the bridge opened.
I mean, what was Staten Island like before there was a bridge there?
Staten Island, actually, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because the first time I came to Monroe, Wisconsin, when I was dating my wife, she's walking me around this town that she lives in, and I turned around and I looked at her and I said, oh my God, I am 7 years old again. She goes, what do you mean? I said, Staten Island. I said, Monroe. I said, your town today is exactly the way Staten Island was before they built a bridge. I mean, it was all, I don't know if you were born and raised on Staten Island, but Staten Island was all farmland. I mean, it was dirt roads. It was, you know, everybody knew everybody. Yeah, and once they built that bridge, it opened up the floodgates. It was just, I get the idea of progress and stuff like that, but, I mean, they just, I'm sorry, but once they built that bridge, you saw Staten Island going down real fast, because, I mean, they were just tearing out beautiful corner homes, beautiful corner homes, and, you know, putting like 20 condos on that piece of property. It was ridiculous. That's why I left Staten Island. It was just getting too overcrowded, and I didn't like it anymore.
As a kid, when did you start playing drums?
Oh, 7 years old, I started playing.
With your parents' blessing?
No, not at all. I used to drive my parents and my neighbors crazy because I played all the time. I was a very hyper child growing up, and every day when I came home from school, the first thing I did was just go downstairs and beat those drums for a good 2 to 3 hours, easy. Every single day I would play my drums, every single day.
So were you playing along to records? What kind of stuff were you listening to?
Actually, my uncle would not let me listen to any rock and roll. His thing on rock and roll was, listen, rock and roll is easy. It's easy to play. Monkeys could play rock and roll. He goes, you're going to learn all the hard stuff first, all the swing, all the jazz, all the Latin, all that stuff. He goes, because once you start listening to drummers like Keith Moon and John Bonham and Charlie Watts and Don Brewer and all these drummers, they were all jazz drummers first, before they played rock. So, and I couldn't listen to any rock. It was all Gene Krupa and Benny Goodman and, you know, all those guys.
So at what age did you start playing in bands, and what year would that be?
Wow. I started playing in bands in, oh my goodness, I was about 10 years old. And just playing with, you know, neighborhood kids. Played with these guys up until I was about, 15, 16 years old, 17. And then I realized that, you know, if I really want to do anything with music, and do it as a profession, I have to get off of Staten Island. I got to start going into New York and start meeting other musicians and stuff like that. So that's what I did. And then I wound up meeting Patrick, who was living on Staten Island, and I wound up meeting Marco, who lived on Staten Island, and was like, okay, so I really didn't have to go to New York to meet, you know, good musicians and musicians who wanted to be professionals. And, I hooked up with Patrick and Marco, and this was in 1978, the end of 77, the end of 78, and we were in a cover band called The Space Between Your Ears. And then Patrick decided that he wanted to write his own songs and start gigging in New York City. And he asked me if I was into it. And I said, sure, you know, I'm definitely into it. And he asked Marco if he was into it. And Marco said, why not? Let's go for it. And we put this band together, and he called it Dirty Looks. And we started playing in CBGBs.
So when you guys were still playing covers, what was your set like? What genres were you playing?
Wow, we did a lot. We would do Zappa, Beatles, Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, even though we didn't have a female singer. What else? Oh my goodness, just a wide variety of bands, because we had Patrick. All three of us had different influences growing up, so we just combined all those influences in this cover band.
I think that's really interesting because, I mean, Dirty Looks and Jefferson Airplane, you know, in every way are miles apart. So it's interesting that there's still an audience for, at that time, for those kind of cover bands, and yet there was also an audience for what would become Dirty Looks. Tell me, what were you guys doing? I mean, I think at least some of the guys were longshoremen, is that right? Or they worked on the docks?
That was me. I was a longshoreman. My family, my dad was a longshoreman, his dad was a longshoreman. I mean, I come from a long family of longshoremen, so when I graduated high school, guess where Peter went? Peter went to work on the docks, just like his dad and his dad before that, yeah.
Which is a pretty good paying job, I imagine.
It was a really, I mean, we're talking 1976, 77, and, I was still living at home. And I was bringing home $475 a week at that time. And at that time, that was a lot of money. Yeah, my father was really upset when I told him that, you know, I'm quitting being a longshoreman to be a professional musician, and I'm flying to London to record my first album. And he was like, what? It's like, yeah, Dad.
So if you look on the web and sort of, there's not that much information about the band Dirty Looks, but the story goes that pretty, you know, after just a few weeks rehearsal, you were playing at CBGB's, and, you know, very quickly you were discovered. And the story on the web is that the bass player of Squeeze at that time, John Bentley, saw you, and he brought someone to see you who quickly got you signed to Stiff Records. Is that sort of correct?
That is pretty much correct. John Bentley was playing at the Bottom Line. After his first show at the Bottom Line, he came down to CBGB's to see a bunch of bands. He saw us, obviously liked us, went back to the Bottom Line, did his second set, came back to see our second set of CBGBs with this girl who worked for a producer. I forgot the guy's name, but he produced Steve Forbit. You remember Steve Forbit?
Sure.
Back in the 80s? Yeah, I forgot the guy's name. And he came down and he saw us at our next gig at CBGB's, and then he turned us on to Andy Cavalieri, who happened to be the manager from Grand Funk Railroad. And he told him about us, and he came down to see our next show at CBGB's, and he really liked us, and he said that he wanted us to come up to his office the following day and sit down and talk and maybe, you know, work out a deal. So we all had full-time jobs. You know, I was a longshoreman. Patrick was a manager at a health food store on Newdorf Lane, and Marco worked in the city as a word processor. So we're driving home from CBGB's, and we say, wow, should we call in sick and go up to this guy's office and see if he's the real deal? And that's what we did. We called in sick. We went up to his office, and sure enough, he was the real deal. You know, he was the manager from Grand Funk Railroad. So we signed a management deal with him, and then 2 weeks later, he got us a record deal with Stiff Epic.
And how much later were you recording your first record in the UK?
Wow, we recorded our first album. Let's see, we got signed in the middle of 1979. We recorded the album actually right before Christmas. We came home. We came home Christmas Eve with the album already done. Yeah, so it was Christmas Eve of 1979, and Epic released the album January of 1980.
So am I right that you're really talking about 6 months from the formation of the band to the record being in stores? Is that possible?
Yep, that's how fast it happened.
Yeah, so we heard Accept Me early in the show, and that's the one song you sing lead vocal on. It sounds, I mean, this record still sounds so great to me, and as a drummer, I think part of the appeal of being in a three-piece is you can always hear the drums kind of crystal clear, and I think the guy who produced that first record did a great job on the drum sound. It sounds, you know, nice and big. He's a guy named Tim Freese Green, and he was in a band called Talk Talk that I don't know too much about. Did you guys want to record the record in England? Did that sound like a good idea to you?
Well, we actually wanted to record it in New York, and we wanted to pick the producer. But our manager said, if we pick the producer, we're going to have to spend at least $10,000. If Stiff Records picks the producer, then they're going to pick up the tab. And our manager said, let's go with their producer, let them pick up the tab, and I want you guys to go to London and record the album so there's no distractions. So you don't have friends wanting to come into the studio and hang out, and you don't have to go home every day and deal with your everyday, you know, things going on. You know, I want you to concentrate on just recording the album. And so that's what we did.
Were you happy with the way it came out, personally?
Personally, not really. I mean, I felt that we were a three-piece power pop rock band. And Dave Robinson, the president of Stiff Records, he always felt that we were kind of like an Elvis Costello type band. You know, it's like, yeah, we're not really an Elvis Costello type band, you know, with that very small, tight sound, you know. I mean, it was great for Elvis Costello. It worked great for Elvis Costello. But it wasn't us, you know. So, I mean, what, we were all young, you know. This was our first record deal, you know. So what do we know, you know what I mean? So they released the album, and it was okay. I mean, you know, a lot of people liked it. A lot of people bought it, and that was a good thing. But we really weren't super happy about the production of the album.
Okay. In 1980, they put you on the Son of Stiff tour. What other bands were on that tour, and was it a crazy scene?
To say the least, there were five bands on the tour. We were one of the five bands. There was a band called Joe King Carrasco. They were from Texas. They played Tex-Mex music, and they were really good. They were fun to hang out with. Then there was another band called Temple Tudor, and they were a hardcore punk band out of London. And then another band called Any Trouble, and they were out of Manchester, England, and they were like a very poppy, you know, kind of an Elvis Costello. The lead singer kind of sang like Elvis Costello and kind of wrote songs like Elvis Costello. And then there was another band, a reggae ska band, out of Birmingham, England. And so now you have five different cultures meeting and touring for 6 months, and it was interesting. It was very interesting. I mean, you know, there were some times where, you know, we would have arguments with other, you know, with other band members and stuff, you know, because of our cultures and stuff. But after a while, you know, we're all musicians. We're all here for the same thing. You know, let's just deal with everybody's, you know, with their different ways of thinking and, you know, and so on and so forth. And I mean, after a while, it just turned out to be a lot of fun. You know, we would invite other musicians, you know, to do a couple of songs and vice versa. And it was just a blast. It really was. And I keep in touch with a lot of these guys still, you know, we still Facebook each other and call each other and stuff. So it was a great experience. It was a really cool experience.
So that first record sold over 100,000 copies, I think. And the Stiff was, had a deal with Epic in the States. So all the records, or the ones they liked, Epic would pick up and put out in the States. And
that's right.
I remember hearing it on the radio in high school in New York City. And, you know, so it was a pretty big record. I mean, I assume you probably made more money as a longshoreman than you were as a rock star. Or am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely correct about that.
Let me remind the audience, we're talking to Peter Parker, who is the drummer of the band Dirty Looks, who are really sort of, you know, one of Staten Island's most visible exports, I think, to the whole world, and a band that I just remember fondly, and a band I've never stopped liking or listening to. For that first album, there's some great videos shot on the streets of New York, and people can go on YouTube and check those out. A lot of energy. Tell me about the band's look. I mean, there's definitely a, you know, if you had to sort of put it in a nutshell, a sort of new wave, skinny tie look about the band. But here you are, three guys, longshoremen or whatever, from Staten Island. Was that something you had to be talked into? You know, again, that sort of disparity between the Jefferson Airplane and Dirty Looks is huge. How did that gap get crossed? Was that a natural thing?
No, actually, I mean, basically, we were all hippies back then, you know. I mean, but I had long hair, Marco had long hair, Patrick had this big afro, and when we sat down with Epic Records, they said, listen, you know, you have to change your image here, you know, because you're playing, you know, so-called new wave punk music, but you don't have that look. So you're going to have that look, you know. And we all look at each other and says, yeah, whatever, you know what I mean? It's like, what, you're giving us a chance to, you know, to record an album and tour? It's like, yeah, I'll shave my head if you need me to, you know. my hair will grow back. I really don't care.
Yeah.
So, and that's what we did.
Around 1980, you made a record with Richard Goddard, a 45, just two songs. Why only two songs with Richard? And was there a plan to make a whole record with him? Or how does that record fit into the Dirty Looks picture?
No, actually, we did. I think it was Lie to Me that we re-recorded, because for some reason, Dave Robinson really liked that song. And it was just a throw-in song, you know. It was something Patrick just wrote really fast, you know. I mean, it was a cute little ditty, but it really wasn't us, you know what I mean? But we needed kind of a mellow, you know, kind of a love song on the album, so we just threw it on the album. And Dave Robinson really liked it, and he felt that the production could have been a little better, so we went in and we re-recorded it. Two times, as a matter of fact. We're two different. One with John Cale and one with Richard Goddard. And it turned out that they didn't like any of the versions that they recorded. So it never got, you know, it never got printed. It never got used.
So for our first album, you guys did really well. You're signed to Stiff, which is kind of a hip record label to be on, and Epic, which is part of a huge company in America. You've gone on this tour. You're getting good press. And so it comes time to make the second record a year later, Turn It Up. And this one's going to be produced by Nick Garvey. And
yes.
Somehow this doesn't go right, and it ends up the record company ends up having it remixed by Roger Bashirian, who worked with Elvis and Nick Lowe and all those guys, and in the end, it seemed like nobody was happy with the result. Is that right?
Boy, you did your homework, huh? Yes, it was. We loved the production that Nick Garvey did, because it was big. It was huge. This recording studio was called Rockfield Studios in Wales. And really nice studio, and we got some really good sound. I mean, it was huge. This guy really captured our sound. And Stiff Records didn't like it, because like I said, you know, Dave Robinson, you know, he always felt that we were like, you know, the next coming of Elvis Costello, you know, and it was like, dude, it's like, what don't you get here, you know? So what they did was, behind our backs, they didn't tell us, they didn't warn us, they didn't say anything. They just took the master, they gave it to Roger Bashirian, and he remixed it, took out background vocals, added background vocals, took out this beautiful sax solo that we had in one of our songs, and then handed it to Epic. And Epic said, what is this? You know, it's like, sorry, but we don't like this. And Epic didn't, you know, they didn't distribute it in the United States. And it only got distributed in Europe, so it was an import album, unfortunately.
So the band, you end up parting ways with Stiff Epic, and you made some demos, I think, for Island, and you spent...
Island Records, yes. Chris Blackwell.
You spent it, you toured around. Your manager that you mentioned, Andy, earlier, he passed away. And then after a while, I guess Patrick just said, I don't want to do this anymore, and that was kind of the end of the band. Is that what happened?
Well, we went in, we did a 12-song demo for Island Records, and I think there was like 4 songs on that demo that were instrumentals with no vocals. And it came back to us and said, hey, I really like the instrumentals, but I don't like the songs with the vocals on it. He goes, so I'm willing to put out an album of all instrumentals. And Patrick was just like, you've got to be kidding me. Really? It's like, what's it, you know, who was going to buy an album of all instrumentals, you know? Except back then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they didn't like his vocals. So he was like, well, you know what? Screw you. You know, who are you to tell me, that I'm not a good singer? And he was just at his wit's end. And he just said, you know what? I am tired of this music business. It's a cutthroat, backstabbing business. He goes, and I'm done. I'm out of here. And that was it. He just left, bailed out. And that was the end of it.
And there's no sign of him on the internet at all. You know, it doesn't seem like he has any nostalgia for this part of his life at all. Are you still in contact with him? Do you know what's going on with him?
I spoke to Patrick. You remember when VH1 were putting the 80s bands back together for one show?
Yes.
Okay, well, they confronted us. They had called us and they asked us if we wanted to do... You know, if we wanted to put Dirty Looks back together again, you know, for a show. And me and Patrick were talking about it, and we said, you know what? It was a 3-piece band. Marco passed away in 95. And it was a 3-piece band, and we just felt that it just wouldn't feel right, it wouldn't be right if we went out with a different bass player and, you know, and did this show. So we opted, you know what? We're not going to do it. And then after that, I spoke to Patrick about maybe 4 years ago. There was a band in Omaha who was a Dirty Looks cover band for years. And they got a hold of me and they asked me if I wanted to come into the studio and record a couple of Dirty Looks songs with them. And it was a female singer in this band. And it was interesting hearing a female sing these songs. because they did a recording of a 12 o'clock high. And to hear a female vocal sing these songs, it was like, wow, this is interesting. You know, she did a really great job. So before I went to Omaha, you know, being that Patrick wrote all the songs, I wanted to make sure that it was okay with him that, you know, I went into the studio and re-recorded, you know, these songs. He goes, I really don't care. He goes, you do what you want to do. You know, it's like, I don't care anymore. You know, I don't want anything to do with this. It was like, okay, cool.
So you mentioned Marco passed away. I think it was from a drug overdose. I think he had problems with drugs for a while, from what I could see. But was this an issue during the Dirty Looks days?
We had our issues. I mean, you know, it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, that's, you know, as cliche as it might sound, it was true. You know, we all dabbled into, I mean, you know, we were all pot smokers when we were young, but then once we got into the music business, we got introduced to all the other heavy drugs, and Marco tends to like it a lot more than me and Patrick did. And he became a real fan of cocaine. And being that Marco was overweight all the time, that's not a good combination. And after Dirty Looks broke up, he was in and out of rehab, you know, trying to clean himself up and stuff. But I guess it got the best of him. And he died in his sleep.
Sad.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame because I really felt that if Marco did not pass away, that we could have probably talked Patrick into getting Dirty Looks back together again and trying to make a go out of it, you know. But once he passed away, that was it. You know, there was no chance at all.
How do you feel about the band's legacy? Do you think they're remembered for what their part in the music scene?
Actually, I'm shocked. I really am. I mean, there was this guy in Italy who's a major fan of Dirty Looks, and he started this Facebook page for Dirty Looks, and it was just amazing. Amazing how many people connected with this Facebook page on Dirty Looks. And then I wound up giving him all of our videos, our live recordings at the St. George Theater, New Year's Eve, the Paramount Theater, and my father's place. And I just gave him all these videos, and he just put them up. He put them up on our Facebook page, and it was just overwhelming reaction to, you know, to the band. I mean, as a matter of fact, yesterday I get this Facebook message from this guy in Detroit who saw us when he was 17 years old. And he just kept on saying, you know, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be the drummer I am today. You know, you're a great band. And it's just, I mean, it's just shocking to find that there's people out there that still love this band, that are still into this band, and yeah, it's pretty cool, actually, to tell you the truth.
So, Peter Parker, you are semi-retired. You lived in Florida for a while. Now you live in Wisconsin. You still, it sounds like you still love to play the drums. It sounds like you haven't lost your energy and your love for this.
No, I still play. I still play. I give lessons. I give drum lessons out of my house. And when I first moved here, I hooked up with a top 40 band doing casinos around the United States and festivals. And then I joined this this country band that did festivals and casinos and stuff. Yeah, I haven't stopped playing. And now, right now I'm playing in a cover band called Midlife Crisis. So yeah, I will never give up playing drums. Never in a million years would I ever give this up. I always tell my wife, if I die, I want to die of a massive heart attack on stage. Please.
Well, I hope your dream comes true, but not anytime soon.
Well, I hope it does, but not too soon.
Exactly. So I want to hear that song, Let Go. It really is, I think, the signature song of the band, and a song that is nothing else. I mean, it's just, this song is like a just dynamite going off, you know?
It was fun recording, I'll tell you why. It was a lot of fun recording that song because it was such a high energy song. And even when I'm in the recording studio, I still play like I'm playing live. You know what I mean? I just don't sit there and, you know, and do my part. You know what I mean? I'm playing. My arms are flaring. I'm all over the place. And the producer was watching me, and he goes, "My God," he goes, "can you calm down a little bit?" It's like, "Nope, sorry. This is the way I play. This is, you know, this is it." You know what I mean? Either love it or leave it.
Yeah, well, I think you can feel that.
But I think that helped us out because we always played, we always recorded like we were, you know, playing live. You know what I mean? Just straight out, Harvey, any overdubs, because we felt that, you know, if we start overdubbing, you know, guitar parts and, you know, vocals and stuff like that, we're not going to be able to produce that same sound live. So we kind of basically, you know, kept it basic, you know.
So on this record of Let Go, are there no overdubs at all?
Hardly any overdubs whatsoever on that album. Yeah, very, very little. Maybe some overdubs on the background vocals, you know, to make them bigger. Very little guitar parts that were, you know, that were overdubbed and stuff. Yeah, we just basically wanted to keep it basic because, you know, when we put out the album, what you hear on the album is what you're going to hear live, you know, which a lot of bands didn't do that, you know.
Well, let's hear it now. It's still, to me, such a fresh sounding record. I mean, I just love this record, and I always want, you know, I always turn this one up to, you know, to as loud as it can possibly go. It just sounds great, just blasting out of the speakers. Peter Parker, thing. You know, there's not that much information about this band. I'm just so pleased we could sort of get to the bottom of a few things.
Well, thank you so much, man. This was cool.